Thank you so much, brethren, for that encouragement as always. I have to have a different computer up here today because just before I came over, I decided to check my tablet to make sure it was ready to go. And I suppose that it came on in its cover and I didn't know it and it ran the battery all down, so can't use it tonight. So tonight I'm going to have to use this one instead so I can hide back here if I need to, I suppose. But we're going to return to our study of the parables. We're in the final week of the life of Jesus as we're telling the parables that we're teaching the parables that came from the last week of Jesus' life. And this is probably, by the time we are covering the parable we're going to look at tonight, we're in the final 2 days or three of the life of Jesus based on the chronologies that we can find in Scripture. And this is probably the shortest and easiest to cover of all of the parables themselves. But the reason that I called this when I first named this the series of lessons the Parables and Discourses of Jesus is because I knew we were going to come to tonight when what's more important about the parable that we're going to talk about tonight is actually the discourse that Jesus goes through to get to the parable. You can't understand the parable without the discourse, and it's a lengthy and very difficult discourse. So I'm going to just talk tonight about a tiny little small parable in the middle of a giant discourse. I don't seem to have a clicker. Oh, no, wait, it's not on. Try it again. There it goes. All right, good. So it's a small little parable in a giant discourse. As we're looking at the discourse itself, there's a great deal of confusion, I guess, among Christians and among those claiming Christianity as to the exact meaning of the things that Jesus says in this particular discourse. It's one of the most hotly debated of all the discourses of Jesus because folks are not seeming to understand whether Jesus is talking about things that are taking place at the end of time or earlier, and we're going to try to clear some things up concerning that as we're going to shed some light this evening on those types of things. And I hope that we can, as a part of this, make a lot of sense out of some things that maybe you've heard all your life that have been sort of crazy or different, all right? So we're going to be in Matthew chapter 24 for the most part tonight, Matthew 24. We're going to look at 41 verses worth of Matthew 24 tonight. And this discourse is found in all three of the synoptic gospels. You can also find it in Mark chapter 13, verses 1 through 32, and in Luke chapter 21, verses 10 through 33. But for the most part, since they're all very, very similar, very slight changes between the three different accounts that are not really worth mentioning, we're going to stick mostly with the Gospel of Matthew, since it is the most complete and fullest of all of these accounts. We'll stick there tonight. But if you have Matthew chapter 24, follow along as I begin to read in verse 1 and 2. Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down." I want you to hold on to the phrase, "all these things," because we're going to see it again later on in the discourse. But for right now, they're walking out from the temple after Jesus has been in there. And in the last couple of chapters in Matthew, prior to this one, Jesus has constantly been in conflict with the Pharisees over different things that they were troubling him about. And so they're leaving the temple, and they're about to go away from Jerusalem again, and then he'll come back one last final time into Jerusalem after this discourse. But anyway, he's about to go out, and the disciples come up to him and say, "Look at these beautiful buildings. Aren't they wonderful?" If you look at Mark and Luke, you know, they're really commenting on the beauty of the buildings and the marvelous architecture of the temple itself. And Jesus says, "You see all these things? Truly, I say to you," and the word "truly" is the word "amen," of course, in Greek. "Amen, I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down." He's, of course, making reference to something that's going to happen in their near history, in their near future, which is our history now. So anyway, they left there and they went to the Mount of Olives, where the disciples approached Jesus to question him on the things that he said there. So when we start this discourse, we need to understand the questions that they ask. To really properly understand the entire discourse, we have to see the questions precisely that were asked by the disciples. And Matthew, starting in verse 3, they ask actually three questions in the Gospel of Matthew, which Jesus will answer in a somewhat orderly fashion. All right? The first question they ask is, "Tell us when these things will happen." Right? When these things will happen. Now, these things are these things that Jesus was mentioning in the earlier verse. And number 2, they ask a second question, "What will be the sign of your coming?" They were expecting the second coming of Jesus, or the coming of Jesus into his kingdom, very soon after the time that they were in. And then the third thing is, what will be the signs of the end of the age. Now, I'm putting in the words the signs because they just say and of the end of the age as the third question. So three questions are asked and three questions are answered in Matthew. And as we trace this down, we'll see all three of those questions very clearly answered by Jesus. Now, in Mark, if you're not paying very close attention, you might consider it to be the exact same thing. But in the Gospel of Mark, there's only really two questions that are asked. We have some more clarification. In Mark 13, verses 3 and 4, we find out, first of all, that it's Peter, James, John, and Andrew are the specific disciples that are asking Jesus these questions, right? So they ask only two questions. When will these things be, which is what Matthew recorded. And secondly, what will be the sign when these things are going to be fulfilled? All right, now these things are all they're talking about there. Now Jesus will answer those questions, and he'll also answer the third question that's not asked in Mark, but is asked in Matthew. So you have to pay attention to that as well. And then if you look at the questions as they're asked in Luke, you'll find that Luke follows Mark very closely and only asks two questions from the disciples that period of time, even though, again, three questions are going to be answered. It's very similar. When will these things be, or when will these things happen? And secondly, what will be the sign that these things are about to take place? And Mark and Luke limit the questions to the two about the immediate subject of the destruction of the temple that Jesus was talking about. And Jesus then volunteers information about his second coming to them in those Gospels. In Matthew, all three of the questions being asked are revealed, and we'll see them all as we go along. So we're going to use Matthew as the guide this evening. Many people try to make these events have to do with the second coming, all the events to do with the second coming. Only a very, very small amount of those responses from Jesus had to do with the second coming. And because of that, there's a great deal of confusion being taught in the world today, including, and they use these verses to bolster the false doctrine of premillennialism and the thousand-year reign of Christ, all right? We're going to see how that happens, but we're also going to see that it's all a fallacy tonight, that Jesus is not talking about those things at all for most of the discourse. Sometime or another during your life, you probably had somebody come up to you and say, you know, I know the end's getting really near. It's getting really near because, I mean, we're hearing about wars all the time. We're hearing about rumors of wars all the time. And they'll quote from these passages to talk about how they're just sure that the end of time is really close and coming very near. Well, almost nothing that they're saying has anything to do with the end of time, folks. Nothing. So we'll see that as we continue on. Jesus is discussing two different events with very clear divisions, if you know what you're looking for, and we'll look at that tonight. Signs for the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, this is what Jesus started off with, the destruction of the temple, which will actually take place at the same time as the destruction of Jerusalem. And we know the precise time of that destruction. It was in AD 70, after a rather lengthy siege by Titus, the general of the Roman army, sent under Vespasian, the Caesar, at that time, to put down and to quell uprisings in Jerusalem and Judea. And they just go ahead and just destroy Jerusalem brick by brick and the temple brick by brick. And they even take the stones of the temple and pulverize them into gravel for the most part, so there's nothing left of that, with the exception of the wall that you see people praying at all the time. It's one of the original wall of the temple at that period of time on the Temple Mount. During the decades after Christ, many arose claiming to be the Christ, and Jesus says that's going to happen. Look at verses 4 and 5 in Matthew chapter 24. Now, see to it no one misleads you, Jesus says, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. Now, folks, again, some folks are trying to make this sound like something that's going to happen in the future. And they're going to, every time somebody on this earth today rises up and says, I'm Jesus, you need to follow me, they're saying, man, the end of time is almost here. People are starting to say they're Jesus again. No, had nothing to do with us at all. They were to be among the signs of the impending doom of Jerusalem. That's what Jesus is talking about as he is discussing these things. And then he says in verses 6 through 8, you'll be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. You see that you are not frightened, for those things must take place. But that is not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And in various places there will be famines and earthquakes, but all of these things are merely the beginning of birth pains. I've looked at old sermons from before World War I, sermons before World War II. In both of those cases, preachers were preaching the end of time and doom and gloom because they said the wars are happening. Now we've got a worldwide war here. The end of time is just any day now. Well, here we are now another 50 or something years after that. The world's still here. God hasn't come back yet. And he didn't tell us that there's ever anything that we possibly know about when the end of time was going to be. Just that we don't know. And we'll see that again later on in the discourse. But in the meantime, Jesus says to them at that time, you're going to be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. Don't be frightened by that. Those things have to happen. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. Various places there will be famines and earthquakes. So every time we have a big famine or an earthquake in the world today, people start rising up saying, well, the end of time is coming. It had nothing to do with the end of time. It had nothing to do with us at all. It had to do with them and their time. The end spoken here is the end of Jerusalem, not the end of the world, and not the second coming of Christ. So be very cautious as you're reading commentaries and such things, not to be misled by those who are not distinguishing between those events in their commentary. All of this has to do with the tribulation of the early church and what was going to happen in the century following the rise of Jesus back to heaven, what was going to happen in the rest of that century of his life on this earth. So look at the tribulation of the early church as Jesus describes in verses 9 through 14, again still in the Gospel of Matthew. Then they will deliver you to tribulation, Jesus says, and will kill you. And you will be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time, many will fall away, will betray one another, and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Now, once again, everybody says, oh, that's the second coming. That's the end of time. Jesus just said the end will come. And so every time you've got periods of time when the fervor of folks for Christ has grown cold, such as what we see, I think, in our nation at this time, everybody's willing to bet that the end of time is really close because folks are wandering away from Christ and nobody loves God anymore. So they're concerned about that, and they think the end of time is coming because of that as a sign that Jesus mentioned here in verses 9 through 14. But remember, this is Jesus talking about those things that were to take place that he was talking about concerning the temple and the Temple Mount. So when he says the end here, he's not talking about the end of time. He's talking about the end of Jerusalem, not the end of the world, the end of Jerusalem, the end of the temple, the end of the temple worship as it was known at that period of time. So verses 9 and 10 do not discuss the second coming. Tribulation was a reality of first century Christianity. They all saw it. They all experienced it. Under Rome, the church suffered for a couple of centuries after the resurrection of Jesus because of Christianity. A betrayal of Christians by Christians, family members and against family members, is well documented in the first century ecclesiastical history, where folks were turning their parents over, people were turning their spouses over to the Romans because they became Christians, because they were not Christians themselves. False prophets are well attested in the Bible, so there's nothing new about that. Jesus is simply saying there's going to be an uprise of false prophets coming in my name during that late first century time prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. There's going to be waning enthusiasm for the gospel. That's, again, well documented during that period of time. The church actually sort of is driven out of the public eye and into the catacombs at one period of time during that strife and persecution that comes from the Romans. So we see that waning enthusiasm for the gospel documented in the scripture as well. In verse 14, I want you to notice, he says, this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, then the end will come. This does not speak of the end of time, okay? The gospel will be preached in the whole world, but not the way that you might think if you're thinking that this has to do with the end of time. So my question is, by the time that Jerusalem was destroyed, if that's what this has to do with, by the time that this Jerusalem was destroyed, was the gospel by that time preached to the whole world? Or is Jesus a false prophet? Well, let's just consider whether the gospel was preached to the whole world or not. By going to the book of Colossians, first of all, chapter 1, look at verse 6 and verse 23, where Paul is talking to the Colossians about his own preaching and his own teaching and the progress of the gospel at that point. And notice in verse 6 he says, the gospel which has come to you just as in all the world also, it is constantly bearing fruit and increasing. Now, Paul, by the time he's writing to the church of Colossae, says that the gospel is being preached in all the world. The whole world is hearing the gospel of Christ. And then look at verse 23. If indeed you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, was made a minister. So by the time Paul is writing to the church of Colossae, he's saying that the gospel has already been preached in the whole creation under heaven. So if we look very carefully at what happens in the first century, we'll see that as far as the civilized world is concerned, where people are known to be and known to be living in civilization at that period of time, that the gospel is preached to all that world by the end of the book of Acts, certainly. Look at Romans chapter 1, verse 8, when Paul says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is being proclaimed throughout the whole world. The faith of the Romans was being proclaimed throughout the whole world. If we're understanding the whole world that Paul is talking about to be the same whole world that Jesus is talking about, then by the end of the book of Acts and the events that are recorded therein, the gospel had already been preached to the end of the earth. All known civilized world was preached to by that time. All the Middle East had been preached to by that time. All the Far East had been preached to by that time. Africa had been preached through by way of Ethiopia, and the Ethiopian eunuch went back to Africa. So Africa had been thoroughly preached to. And Europe was preached to by the time Paul gets done with his missionary journeys. He's already gone into Western Europe, and then eventually the gospel spreads from there to Eastern Europe and so on. And so From those areas, all the world had been reached before the end of the book of Acts during the lifetime of Paul. Paul was martyred before the fall of Jerusalem, AD 70, sometime in the late AD 50s, is when Paul is put to death in Rome for the gospel of Christ. So as Jesus is talking to the disciples about what's coming, the end at that period of time is not the end of the world, but just the end of the city of Jerusalem and the temple itself, since that's what Jesus is talking about at the time. Just before the fall of Jerusalem, verses 15 through 28, this is a long section with these following highlights. I'm not going to read the whole thing, a long section, but here's the highlights that Jesus brings to light for them. So first of all, when you see or hear of the abomination of desolation, now that is not something that's going to happen at the end of time with the second coming of Christ and the entrance of a millennial kingdom, as is taught by premillennialists, who are taking bits and pieces from the book of Daniel, bits and pieces from the book of Revelation, bits and pieces from this particular passage right here, trying to shoehorn them all together, make them make sense out of something that's going to happen in the future, and they come up with a really wrong 2 plus 2 equals 4, they think, but 2 plus 2 for them equals like 6.5. So they're way off, but here we go. The abomination of desolation makes reference to a passage in Daniel and the foreign invasion of Antiochus Epiphanes at that period of time with the Persian army, and Rome's invasion is compared to that by Jesus at this period of time. So when they see Rome approaching, Christians are warned by Jesus to flee. They're going to be aware that Rome is on the march, that they're going to be coming toward Jerusalem. So he's saying to the Christians at that period of time, you pay attention to the signs, look for the wars and rumors of wars to be talked about. As soon as you hear about those things and you see that abomination of desolation coming toward you, then get out of Jerusalem as fast as you can. That fleeing has nothing to do with the false teaching about the rapture, which is not a thing at all. Now, we're going to see later on why folks think that the rapture is a thing, but it's not a thing. If you're worried about the rapture and your car suddenly being driverless, like some of the bumper stickers say, don't worry about that at all, all right? There's not going to be a rapture ever that's going to take place. The rapture is something made up in the minds of men. Such a violent occurrence that Jesus says will never happen before or would ever happen afterwards has to do with the destruction of Jerusalem, which, historically speaking, resulted in the death of over 1 million people in and around the environs of Jerusalem during that siege and during the destruction of Jerusalem, which is more than people have ever been killed in one single battle or one single siege from that time to this period of time and onward, all right? So Jesus was not over-exaggerating that as well. I've forgotten the exact number that Josephus puts in, but it's well over 1 million folks that were killed as a result of that march of the Romans at that period of time. So now we come to verses 29 through 31, and this is what I'm going to call the most confusing part of the whole discourse, all right, the most confusing part, because Jesus is going to do what sometimes Middle Easterners do, and he's going to do some circular reasoning rather than linear reasoning like we're used to, okay? We're used to Paul, who was educated by the Greeks, so he has linear thinking in his letters, and everything follows chronologically. Luke does the same thing, so it's chronological. Then we deal with Matthew, and we deal especially with Jesus and his teaching, and it's not always linear, so we're a little confused. But we're going to look for a couple of really important statements from Jesus that will help us to make our way through this this sort of swampy area in the discourse and come out on dry land. I look at verse 29 and start with me there. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from the end of the sky to the other, from one end of the sky to the other. All right? This is the second coming being discussed here. All right? This is the second coming. Now, we're not going to expect for the moon to suddenly go dark and stars to fall out of the sky. That's apocalyptic literature to just discuss something great, some major occurrence of historical import and also of ecclesiastical import for the whole churches. So immediately, Jesus is using this as part of the same dispensation of the last days. So it was not going to happen like in the next few days of their life, but immediately in this last dispensation of time, which we're still living in, we're still a part of, and the apocalyptic literature is metaphorical of great events, and so we need to be paying attention to that. The one thing that we're going to see that's important is all the tribes of the earth, he says, will mourn when they see Christ coming again. And they're going to be mourning because that's going to be the final end. There's not going to be a chance after that for anyone to repent or come back to Christ. So now let's talk about the angels and what is known as the parousia of Jesus, which is the second coming. taking some words from the Greek event immediately that Jesus is discussing here. He says he's going to send forth the angels. The sending forth of the angels is a sure sign of the second coming, as per the illustrations that we saw in the parables of Jesus earlier, like, for example, the separating of the goats and the sheep. In that, the angels do that. The gathering of the tares out of the field of wheat, the angels do that. They're sent into all the earth to do this harvesting. So that's what Jesus is talking about here. The gathering of the elect is a sure sign of the second coming. When these things are clarified, we now get to the parable of the fig tree. So tonight's parable is now right in the middle of that long and very involved discourse. So let's look at the parable, which we'll be done with in about 15 seconds, right? Now learn the parable, Jesus says, from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Now, we have to be very cautious here about understanding where Jesus is putting the parable. That's the whole parable, by the way. It's done. Basically, it says the fig tree gives you some indication that it's about to turn to spring. The leaves, the branches become tender. The leaves start to jump forth. You know the summer's near. So you too, when you see all these things, realize that the end is near. He's near right at the door. Now, I want you to notice again, all these things. I told you to hang on to that phrase because it's very important for the whole discourse. All these things is very important for you. So we're going to look at that. These things is different from that day, okay? As you're reading this discourse, remember that these things is one set of history and that day is another set of history. One is the past and the other is the future for us. Both of them were the future for them. So with the parable, we have sort of a segue between the two subjects of destruction of Jerusalem and the second coming. And the parable is a segue between those two things. Unless we treat it that way, we will fall into all the false doctrine concerning premillennialism and so on that so much of the world has fallen into. So when Jesus says these things, he's referring back to the destruction of Jerusalem. So in verse 33, he says, so you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he's near, right at the door, right? We see all these things. When you see the armies coming, when you see the desolation of the abomination of desolation coming, when you see all of these things that I've told you about, the wars and the rumors of wars, he's going back to that earlier discussion. We see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Well, he is near means the coming of the Christ in his kingdom as the old kingdom is done away with and that old city of Jerusalem is leveled to the ground. And Christ is going to come fully into his kingdom by AD 70 when that takes place, right? In verse 34, he says, this generation will not pass away until these things take place. Well, that's the only way we can understand that. This generation means the people he's talking to immediately and probably their children as well. But that one generation of people, he says, are not going to pass away before these things take place. Now, if Jesus goes to the cross at roughly 30 A.D., I know that we say 33, but he was born about 4 B.C., not 0 B.C., all right? So if we understand that, and the chronology is off from the monk in the 7th century, whatever it was, when he wrote the categories, or did the figuring of the calendars, and when we realize he was off by a few years, then we can make that leap pretty easily. So if Jesus goes to the cross around 29 or 30 A.D., and then 70 A.D. is the destruction of Jerusalem, that's about one generation's worth, about 40 years between those periods of time when Jerusalem is destroyed. So Jesus says, these things, this generation will not pass away until these things take place. The parable looks backward to the earlier discussion, while Jesus has already moved forward to the parousia and talking about the future. And he's going to go back to that, to the future, in verses 36 through 41. And this is what has to do with us and the end of time for us and the second coming of Christ. Because notice he doesn't say, but as these things, which talks about the past, but now he says, but as for that day. As for what day? Well, the day that the apostles asked about when they said, what's going to be the sign of your coming again, your second coming? They didn't understand when they were asking that question exactly what Jesus meant by the second coming. They thought it was going to happen just any day after Jesus left. I'm going to go away. I'm going to go to the Father. I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm going to come back. And you're going to be with me, and that's going to be a period of about a week and a half. So get ready, right? That's what they were thinking, but that's not what Jesus was meaning, okay? So we now know 2,000 years later that that's not what Jesus meant. But look at verses 36 through 41. But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Now when Jesus says these things, Jesus is the Son, emptied of all expression of deity on this earth, and he's saying to them at that period of time, even I don't know the exact day right now in the flesh. I don't know. Only God knows. Now Jesus is, of course, 100% God when he's in heaven. So when he returns to heaven, I think at that period of time, Jesus knows and understands because Jesus has always known and understood what was going to happen. Right? But at that period of time, as he's on the earth, he's emptied himself of all expression of God, of Godhood, and he is living as a man on the earth, 100% man. And so he says, as of that day and hour, the day of my second coming and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Right? So Jesus basically says, when the coming of the Son of Man comes, it's going to be just like the days of Noah. When people were doing what they always did every day, nothing changed, and they thought that each day was going to be exactly the same as the day before. And so at that period of time, they weren't paying attention. Now, if you're not paying attention to this, then you're going to get confused again by the next words when Jesus seems to then go back to this whole premillennial idea and the rapture idea, right? Which is so often taught. Because he says, then there will be two men in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. Now, if no one had ever taught the doctrine of rapture, you would never have the false doctrine of rapture. You would never think anything else about this except for what Jesus just said. But because of the false doctrine of rapture, you've got bumper stickers that say, in case of the rapture, this car will be driverless and beware, and that sort of stuff, right? It's all ridiculous, folks, but that's what people think, right? These verses do not support the rapture view. They do not support a premillennialism view. They don't support any of that. They're Jesus explaining how bad it's going to be if you're not ready when he comes back again, all right? The comparison between Noah and Jesus and what happens when that day arrives is what's at the forefront of this. So if a person is left, all right, then it's not because they're going to have another 1,000 years to get things right. It's because they're left because they're going to go to destruction. So let's look at how Jesus makes that comparison. When Noah went on the ark, those who were left, which is the comparison we're making, were completely destroyed by the flood. They were all wiped out. Every man, woman, and child of them were wiped out. If they were not on the ark, as the 8 people were, then every other human being on the face of this earth was wiped out completely at that flood. When Jesus comes, those who are left are going to be eternally condemned to hell. There's not going to be a second chance for them. If you're left behind at that period of time, you're left behind because you're about to be destroyed completely when your body and soul are cast down into hell for all eternity. This is not a leaving which can result in another chance. So if you've made the mistake of reading all the Frank Peretti books, Left Behind series, and got yourself scared to death by that, just ignore that because it's all a bunch of fiction and nothing's true about any of it. It's all premillennial doctrine. It's all a rapture doctrine. It has nothing to do with the truth at all. There's not going to be a second chance. So that's what Jesus is basically saying to them in the rest of this discourse, all right? If you're not ready when Christ comes again, it's too late. You're going to be left, and that's it, the end, forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. It's the end for your chances of ever making it to heaven. So Jesus continues by saying, be ready. Verses 42 through 44 are at the conclusion of his thoughts. You've got to be alert. You've got to be ready. You don't know when Jesus is coming again. We don't know the last hour. We don't know when all of this is going to come to an end. So you've got to be ready every single day. Now, Jesus is talking about two different events in history. One is second coming, which hasn't happened yet. The first part is the destruction of Jerusalem, which has already happened many, many, many hundreds of years ago. And so now we have this fullness of this discourse with one short little parable in the middle, which we looked at very quickly. The parable is this. As you see the tree begin to green up in the spring, and then the leaves pop up shortly after that, and as all of this happens very quickly, you just need to be ready. You need to be ready. When Jesus comes, you need to be ready. When Jesus is tearing, you need to be ready. As long as we're on this earth, we need to be ready, because we don't know the day and we don't know the hour and we don't know when Christ is coming back again. So if you're not ready tonight, then this may be your last chance. We don't know because, again, it happens very quickly in the blink of an eye. So if you're not ready tonight, if you've never been baptized into Christ Jesus, dying to himself and being crucified with Christ, being buried in the waters of baptism, being raised up to walk in newness of life, if you've never done that and you're ready to do that tonight, won't you come? If there's any other way we can serve you, any way we can help you, anything we can do for you, if we can pray for you, if we can help you in any way, let us know as we stand and as we sing the selected song.